Hi there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, so today's episode is a recording of a mini seminar that Emil, one of our JREP members, and I have held for Singapore's Quantic Business School alumni. Since many of them are interested in Japan, with a large number of them actually living here or regularly visiting for various purposes, they've apparently been interested in Japanese real estate for quite some time, and we were asked to organize a quick presentation and then a longer Q&A session for them, which we of course happily agreed to. And the result is this close to 2 hours super informative session, which covers a huge amount of topics, including market basics, the advantages of investing in Japan, the buying process itself, available financing solutions for resident and non-residents, yields, prices in various locations, short-term stay options, medium-term, such as monthly rentals and long-term tenancy leases, depreciation, retainment of property value, potential growth, resale options, investment strategies, property management, Japanese tenants, what are they like, demolition and resale of building complexes to developers, getting your funds into and out of Japan, earthquakes, taxation, you name it. So super interesting in-depth conversation with a bunch of very savvy people, which both Emil and I really enjoyed chatting with. I hope you have as much fun listening to this one as we did on the day.
So let's start with a welcome and you guys' intro while the last people come in already.
Yes, sure. Okay, thank you so much. So should I start from myself?
Okay, sure. Introduce yourself quickly.
Go ahead. In that case, I'll just remove the spotlight and then you can.
Let me have 2 minutes. Thank you so much. Let me have 2 minutes to share my screen, right? Right, to share the screen. If not, I will send in the file in the chat. So that's okay too.
Oh, there you go. I gave you a permission now.
Okay, thank you so much. Right, so everybody, welcome to one of the very exciting events in this season. So we have a QAS Japan Signature Series here. So I'm Nancy. I'm running Quantic Asia Society at the moment. So yes, let me introduce a little bit about Quantic Asia Society if you're new to this society. So it is the society that created by our alumni, and then we connect with the students, not only in Asia, but around the world. So please join us. So what do you have when you join us? So first of all, the access to the interactive community in WhatsApp chat and some PRs in LinkedIn for sure, right? And we deliver some events to facilitate you in three signature series, gaining ground that will give the mentor to give you some advice for career work and job and school and making moves for some information if you are migrating to overseas, changing careers, or you're doing parenting with the MBA. And last but not least, Culture Unshocked. We did for Turkey, we did for Taiwan, and we did already for Japan. And we are looking to give you some information about the cultural exchange in other countries too. So here is our chat directory. So please feel free to join us for conversation. We are all welcome you there. And please don't forget to introduce yourself with a link to your LinkedIn, for example. Yes. And tonight we are having the QAA's Japan Signature Series for Real Estate in Japan. And Benjamin, our country coordinator, is our host tonight. Yes. So thank you so much for the introduction. And yes, that's all from me.
Thank you, Nancy. Okay, let me just say a few words as well. My name is Benjamin. I run the QAS in Japan, which is basically our alumni group here. On our chats, the topic of real estate came up several times, and there was a lot of demand. And then Holger, who unfortunately couldn't be here tonight, he put us in touch with Emil and Ziv, who I happen to know as well. I've been following their podcast for over a year. It was a great way to be able to answer a lot of questions, or to answer a topic, or to talk about a topic that a lot of people had questions about. The way it's going to work tonight is we're going to have a 45-minute presentation from Emil and Ziv, and then 15 minutes of curated Q&A. So please put your questions into the chat box. After the hour is over, we're going to open the floor for those who want to dive a little bit deeper into the topic, who have a little bit more time, and then you can ask maybe more specific questions directly. But of course, you can always email them or contact Emil and Ziv afterwards, and I'm sure they can talk to you directly as well. A little plug for an upcoming event as well. If you're in Japan, next Friday, March 24th, we have a Hanami viewing party. So if you want to get together with your fellow alumni, check in the QAS Japan chat or the LinkedIn page from Quantic Japan. And finally, let me just introduce our two hosts. And I want to say thank you for making the time for us. So Emil Gorgiz is the founder of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo-based real estate agent specializing in helping foreigners purchase personal homes and investment properties in Tokyo. Emil has also offers mortgage brokerage services to clients utilizing typical low-interest Japanese loans. And then Ziv Nakajima Magen co-founded and has been operating Nippon Trading International for over a decade, a firm specializing in assisting foreigners research, source, acquire, manage real estate property in Japan. And they also, like I said, have a great podcast, which I've been following for a year. So floor is over to you. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Let me grab the spotlight. Great. Everyone, thank you so much for joining. Let's get into it. We don't have a great deal of time, as Benjamin said. So we've sort of put together a bit of a slide deck that both Ziv and I are going to sort of speak to, and just sort of to cover the main points about real estate in Tokyo, be it investing or home purchases. And then you can sort of ask some questions in the chat, but we're also going to open it up for some, if you want at the end for some Q&A, you can disable your microphone and enable your mic and camera and ask directly. I know this is set for 1 hour, but Ziv and I, and maybe some others, we're happy to sort of kick on and just keep the Zoom running for a little bit longer as well. So we have time anyway. So anyone who wants to stay even afterwards, please feel free to stay. And I noticed in the chat, we have people from, not just Asia, but like I saw briefly, like Stockholm and Chicago as well. So awesome. Fantastic stuff. Let me just get the presentation out. Here we go. Okay, so let's start it. So who we are. So I'm a real estate agent here in Tokyo. My name is Emil. I'm an Aussie. I've been here for 20 years in Japan. May will be my 20th year. I have a Japanese wife and three little children who are currently in Australia. That's why it's nice and quiet in my home right now. I'm the founder of realestate.jp. We are a licensed real estate agency in Tokyo. Most of the properties that I deal with tend to be like just really based in Tokyo, more central Tokyo. I focus primarily on personal home purchases. So if you want to buy a home in Tokyo and you're resident here, that's what I do. But also now with the low yen, there's lots of interest of people investing in Tokyo. So that's what I also do if you want to buy investment property here in Tokyo. And Ziv, I'll let you speak as well. Do your little
Yeah, thanks. So I'm Ziv Nakajima again. Been here living in Japan for about 11 years now, but coming and going roughly 20, 25 years. And my partner, Chikako, and I co-founded Nippon Tradings International, or NTI for short, about 11 years ago. And as Emil was saying, we help people. The vast majority of them are non-residents of Japan, but also quite a few, maybe 20% of our clientele are expats who live in Japan. And we help them buy and sell and manage their real estate portfolios, regardless of what's in them. So if, depending on the city, we'd use facilitate our services through agents like Emil or more traditional Japanese agents in other cities, and just help people just bridge that cultural and language gap that we'll probably touch on during the presentation as well.
Sure. Thank you. Okay. So let's just move through. So why invest in Japan? And this one I'm going to hand over to Ziv, because I think he'll be able to speak about that better than I do. Go ahead, mate.
Yep. So Japan, I'd maybe start from why not invest in Japan. So maybe the differences that should be apparent to people who are considering this market is, firstly, it's not a capital growth-based environment. I mean, it could be occasionally. We've had just recently 10 good years, but that's on the back of 25 bad years. So it's not a, if the real estate idiom is usually property will always go up, cycles of 7 years and so forth, I wouldn't apply that to Japan. People come here for different reasons. So they come here for very stable, reliable cash flow. Like Emil was writing on the slide there, yields in central Tokyo, central Osaka, maybe 3-4%. Other parts of the country can go up to 6-8%. In stable, reliable population and economy. And the other thing is, it's the only country in Asia Pacific region that doesn't have any ownership limitations on non-resident owners. So anyone can buy land in Japan and property in Japan. It's 99% freehold. There's almost no leasehold property. And it's also a very safe and stable and hassle-free market. Just those of us living in Japan probably are familiar with the Japanese psyche and character. But generally speaking, the tenants, the professional companies that you work with, insurance companies, building management companies, government authorities, everyone is very by the book. Everything has a paper trail several miles long, and it's a very, there's always legal recourse. It's a very safe, stable, regulated market.
I think that's a very important point to reiterate, because in Asia, that's not the case. About you, any foreign investor or any investor anywhere around the world can own outright without restriction real estate in Japan. And there is no additional cost or additional taxation to foreign ownership in Japan. So I believe, you know, we have lots of people from Singapore on here. I think if I want to just buy a house or land in Singapore as a foreign resident, as a non-resident foreigner, I believe that's very, very complex or very costly, if possible, if it's even possible. Whereas in Japan, you can never have stepped into the country, just send over your cash and say, you know, here's my notarized address, name and address, and send it to the scrivener, the legal scrivener here in Japan, and the title that you pay for will be of land will be registered into your name as the owner wherever you live, completely freehold and with the same amount of rights as a Japanese citizen or as a permanent resident here in Japan when they buy property.
That's correct. And legally and logistically, all properties in Japan are available for non-residents to buy. If you look at Australia, for example, non-residents are only allowed to buy brand new developments or properties that are just currently being released off plan or on plan. And if you look at Singapore, like you said, I mean, 80% of the market is in Singapore is HDB. It's not even available to non-residents. So Japan is the only country in the Asia Pacific region that has absolutely no logistics and legal limitations on non-residents buying property. On the ground, though, that's a different story. We'll get to that a bit later.
Okay. Now let's look at the buying process. Just make it a little bit larger, Ziv. 1 second. All right, so the buying process is actually it's quite straightforward. It's quite involved, but you as the buyer don't have to do a lot. Initially, we search for a property. So someone like myself or like Ziv will hear your requirements, what you'd like to do, and then we'll begin the search. When we find a property, we'll do the due diligence, of course, and check, okay, is this the right property? If it's an investment property, we'll look at things like the returns it's getting, the current tenants, then the age of the property. Has there been any issues, for example, deaths or suicides in the property? These kind of things that really impact the value, okay? Or is there a freeway going to be developed across the road from, through the building, or is there a proposed significant construction nearby? Whilst we do that, if we find a property we like, a lot of foreign investors will be cash buyers, okay? But if you're resident here, you may be looking at financing, and we'll talk about financing in one of the later slides. And also, even if you're a non-resident, you can still now, we're finding options for investment financing for non-residents. A little bit more complex, but that's something that we will also arrange. So we need to arrange financing. Once the financing is secure, or if you're a cash buyer, then we don't worry about that. That's when we start negotiating with the seller and make an offer. Okay. And once the offer is accepted, then we agree to sign the contract of sale and pay a deposit. Once that contract of sale is done and deposit is paid, it's locked in. You begin the process of applying for the bank financing, or if it's cash, then you're transferring over the rest of the funds to a Japan account. And then there's an agreed settlement date. And that settlement date is when all the funds are paid to the seller and you receive the title. If it's financing that's arranged, the bank will actually pay all the borrowings into your personal bank account. And then from your personal bank account, you'll pay the seller. And that all happens at the bank generally, or at our office. And even if you can't, if you're foreign based, you don't have to come to Japan. Myself or the scrivener will have power of attorney to sign the documents on your behalf. But we all physically meet in our office. And once the funds transfer is confirmed by the seller, the scrivener will then take your documentation and the title transfer documentation, take them to Ministry of Affairs and transfer the title into your name. And then you have it. You don't have to do a lot. You really kind of just have to negotiate. You tell us how much you want and what you want to negotiate, what price. And when it's agreed upon, all those administrative aspects are kind of handled by us, like the agent and the scrivener. So you don't need to worry. There's usually two agents involved, which would be, there'll be two agents involved, which are, like myself or Ziv, for example, and the seller side agent. And then there's a seller and you the buyer, and there's a scrivener as well, and maybe a bank. So you have so many different parties all with the same goal in mind. We all know what needs to be required. We've all got the contract and we know what dates each thing needs to be done. So you can't really, you don't have to worry so much. You have five other people involved that are making sure everything goes accordingly and nothing gets stuffed up. So it's a pretty smooth, safe process, and all the real nasty, annoying administrative stuff that you have to put up with when doing business in Japan is handled by us and the administrative side, not really by the buyer. We'll tell you what you need to sign and what you need to stamp, and it's very straightforward. Okay. Ziv, is there anything you want to add to the buying process?
No, I think there's a fewer complexities involved when the buyer is not a resident. But as Emil was saying, those are usually sold with a power of attorney, a limited power of attorney document that enables us to handle this sort of procedure on people's behalf. The main complexity here is in the case of investment properties, you want to make sure that the property management company, in Emil's company's case, for example, they're accustomed to working with foreigners, but in other locations in the country, if you're dealing with a non-resident owner and the property management company that's never worked with a foreigner or a non-resident owner, then there will be some level of middlemanish management involved. There will be need to be somebody who's receiving the income into a Japanese bank account, paying the expenses from a Japanese bank account, providing all of the third parties with a local address, local phone number to contact, and so forth. So again, in Tokyo, that can be handled. There are English-speaking professionals in Tokyo, Osaka. There's less and less of them the further away from Tokyo you move, but at some point you will need some middle management involved in the management section, at least.
Thank you. Okay. Now I want to touch on financing options. So for lots of foreign investors, it'll be a cash purchase. If you're looking to buy your own home, so if you're someone like myself, or like Ziv or Benjamin, you've been living in Japan, you know, you work here, you're resident, you have either a work visa or a permanent residency, like what I do, you're eligible for a typical Japanese home loan. And they are sort of probably better than what you've heard. The financing will be often 105% financing. Remember, this is for personal home. You have to be resident, and it's for personal use, not investment. 105% financing. And what that means is it pays for all the 100% of the property cost, and closing costs come to about 5 to 7%. So all those closing costs as well can be included in the loan. So I've got a client now, they just bought a house, like 92.5 million yen. Was so almost like 900,000 US, or I guess with the current exchange, 800,000 US. But yeah, 92.5 million yen. And about 6 million yen in closing costs. And they got a loan for 98 million yen. So the loan covers everything, the purchase price plus all the closing costs. And the buyer is about $500, $600 cash out of pocket. Okay, because the loans only come in $1,000 increments. So anything that's not that, they have to pay cash out of pocket. His interest rate is 0.425%. Okay, that's a variable interest rate, but it's been the same for about 14 years now. And that's on a 35-year term. The other option for if you would like an investment property as a resident of Japan, be it you're a Japanese citizen or a foreigner, the loan terms are not as attractive as with a home loan. You'll need to put 20% deposit. So you get 80% financing, 20% deposit, and again, about 5 or 6% closing costs. So you need to have about 25% cash yourself. The interest rate will be about the low 2% or maybe up to 3%. So between 2 to 2.7, 2.8% is what they are for investments. And the loan term is a little bit shorter. It's 25 years. And lastly, this is probably one of the loans that could interest many people on this call who are non-residents. So, you know, you live in Singapore, you live in the US, live in Australia, you know, Thailand, wherever it may be. Now there's one bank that we started working with. It's actually the very first client who's trying to do this process. So we haven't actually done this yet. He's an American guy with a Japanese wife. They live in Japan. They live in the US, and they are now establishing a company in Japan. And that the bank, the lender, will actually give that company a business loan for an investment property. They'll give 60% financing. The interest rate, I think, is actually 2.8% for this particular deal on a 25-year term. So they're looking at like 120 million yen property and the bank is going to give them about 70 million. I think 65 to 70 million is what they've said on a 25-year term. So still good interest rates. So now all they need, instead of needing a million US, they only need about 500,000 or 600,000 US in order to purchase this. It's actually a full building. It's a three-story building with about 9 or 10 small units in it. And that returns about 6%. And it's down here in Tokyo. So that is the investment loan option for non-residents. One challenge with this, though, right now is even if they establish a corporation, they may not be able to get a bank account for that corporation. A corporate bank account is becoming very difficult, even for residents. And in this case, this company has a non-resident director, which will make it even more challenging. So we're still trying to figure out how to go around that one. But once we succeed in it, and we have sort of a bit of a model for it, then I think we'll be in a strong place to sort of offer this approach to more clients.
Emil, hit me up after the event. I'll tell you how to get around that.
Sure. Thanks. I think we may have brainstormed some similar stuff already, but yeah, cheers. And okay. So that's the financing side of stuff. I think, look, that covers most of it. I don't want to spend too much time in getting in the real nitty gritty of, I've got like a 90 minute version of this presentation that talks about the difference between mansions and houses, the width of the street, if it's a narrow street or if it's a wide street, stuff that, some more complex items when you're looking to buy, especially your personal home. But due to the nature of this talk, I think we'd rather have Q&A because everyone's got a little bit more unique circumstances and maybe their own kind of questions about how the Japanese market works. So I think we'll...
Amy, may I just make a suggestion? Could you guys perhaps give a broad overview about the regional differences in the markets, Tokyo versus Yokohama and Osaka and Fukuoka, and perhaps what you guys recommend or what can be expected or how they differ?
From an investment perspective or just general market fundamentals? Or?
I would maybe both, but I would guess from an investment perspective, because if somebody buys for their personal use, they will live in an area anyway.
Correct.
Sure. Well, I'll let Emil start with Tokyo because that's his expertise.
Sure. I think Zib, I'll leave it to you. I think this one is really about more different regions. So I know just Tokyo well. I focus in Tokyo. Ziv, on the other hand, does every other area of Japan a lot more than I do. So I think you can talk about the differences.
We do occasionally do Tokyo, but yes, mostly other places. So Japan's basically got the big six or seven cities. I think these are all good locations to invest in, but by nature, because they're big metropolitan centers, yields tend to be lower and prices tend to be higher. So obviously, Tokyo's second biggest city is Yokohama, which enjoys a lot of the same fundamentals of Tokyo, but is still, it's rural enough. Yokohama is Japan's second biggest city, but the vast majority of the population is focused around 3 or 4 or 5 stations along the port, and everything else is still very suburban. So you can still find very good deals in Yokohama that you wouldn't be able to find in Tokyo and Kawasaki. And then other big cities are Osaka, Sapporo, Nagoya, Fukuoka, Kyoto. And I think that's it for the big ones. And then we get on to, so all of these cities, with the exception of maybe Sapporo, where you can get slightly higher returns, they would usually be characterized by something like up to 5.5% net pre-tax annual return, if you're lucky, with Tokyo and Osaka being closer to 3-4%. But the advantages of investing in locations like these is obviously that the population, without getting too deeply into the topic, but generally speaking, Japan is obviously the poster child for declining population around the world. But what this means in practice is that people are moving from the smaller townships, which are dying out, into the bigger metropolitan centers. And that's a trend that's probably going to continue for at least the next 2-3 decades. And hopefully by then something will change. But even if it doesn't, Tokyo, Osaka, the big 6-7 cities that we've just talked about, will continue to enjoy stable and or a growing population in the next few decades. Then you're getting into prefectural capitals and satellite cities. So cities that are the biggest in their individual prefectures or cities that are close enough to any of those bigger metropolitan centers that people are actually commuting in and out of the city on a weekly basis. And those will get slightly higher returns. Prices are slightly lower. You will get maybe up to 6, 6.5, 7% if you're lucky in those kinds of cities. And then beyond that, there are the smaller townships that, aside from a few exceptions, are probably in risk of losing population a bit more rapidly for an investment perspective, at least. It could be good for holiday home purposes, but if you're counting on a tenant base that's rapidly declining, then it's probably better to stick to the other locations. Sorry, like Emil was saying, he's got a 90-minute version of his presentation. I can go on like this for days. So maybe Q&A or any topics that you want us to focus on, we'll happily do that.
So we have one more question here. We have a few questions, but one which I found quite interesting was about Airbnb, using Airbnb. I know there is a very unique restrictions on having Airbnb in Japan. This particular person was interested in buying a property in Tokyo for their own stay for vacation, but then optimizing rent earnings for the periods when they're not there. So maybe you can expand that a little bit into kind of the opportunities with Airbnb and the massive restrictions you have.
I think I'm probably better suited to talk to that one, because during the peak, I had 12 Airbnb properties. This was just pre-regulation 2018, and then I cut down to 6 properties. Then COVID hit, and we, over the years, 3 years of COVID, they dwindled down, and now there's no more Airbnbs. We've completely left the Airbnb game, but I've definitely got my hands dirty with it. Japan has a strict regulation in terms of the short-term stays called Minpaku, M-I-N-P-A-K-U. So in 2018, the Japan government introduced Minpaku regulations. It's like this house sharing, short-term stay rules, because a lot of these properties were in a gray legal area. They're not just residential, but they're not registered hotels. They don't have to meet the safety requirements. They don't meet the management requirements of a typical hotel that they've had a category for. So they created a new category and you have to register for it. But in order to protect the residents and kids as well, they said was, then and at a nationwide level, you can only do Airbnb stay or short-term stays across multiple platforms combined 180 days per year. Okay, so you can have an Airbnb property. You can't run it full-time as Airbnb though. Only 180 day, nights of bookings is max. For this person's question, it sounds like they want to have their own property. And while they're not there, you know, maybe just, you know, two, three, four months a year, maybe use the property for themselves. And when they're not in it, you put it on Airbnb. And that's what quite a lot of people are doing. It's to make up for the dead money, the empty nights. They may as well get someone to come in. One of the issues with that, though, is each ward as well, each city, municipality, can have additional rules that they've stacked on top of the government's regulations of 180 days plus a few other restrictions. So, for example, why I'm in Setagaya, if it's in a restricted residential area, you can't operate during school days. So you can only have bookings from Friday through to Sunday. Okay, so that's only 3 nights a week. And in Shibuya City, you can only have bookings on school holidays in the restricted zones. So right now, people that want to buy investment properties with the sole purpose of making it an Airbnb, they're not actually thinking of Airbnb or Minpaku registration. They are getting a place that can get a hotel registration, a full hotel license. So it can operate 365 days. So often that means either like a very specific building that they purchase Or in fact, they'll just buy a block of land and build a basically like an apartment complex that meets the hotel regulations. Okay. So that's what investors are doing now with regards to that. And the other important one to keep in mind is almost any apartment building or a mansion is what we call them in Japan. Almost all of them are not going to be permitted for Airbnb. One of the rules in the regulation change was if you live in an apartment building, the bylaws, the owner's association laws of that building must specifically be updated to say short-term stay is permitted. If it's not explicitly stated that it is approved and it is permitted, the assumption is that it's not permitted. So you cannot register for Airbnb, and you cannot register for the short-term stay registration license. Without that license, you cannot put it on the Airbnb system. You cannot put it on the bookings.com system or any other platform. So you need to be very, very specific about the property that you purchase. And if you want to, that it is in a zone that allows you to do Airbnb more than whatever is unusually restricted. And also, it's not going to be a mansion. It needs to be sort of a standalone house. So I hope that answers that particular question.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Is there a way to get around the Airbnb restrictions by renting on a monthly basis only, like a medium term?
So the rule is anything that's short term under 28 days, or even if it's over 28 days, that anything that is done using like the Airbnb platform or any of those web platforms for it, then they count as being short-term stay nights. So even if someone...
It's essentially whether the leasing is done with the tenancy lease in place or not. If it's done short-term stay style, meaning check-in, check-out, online booking, means nobody actually came into an office and signed a tenancy lease, then it falls under short-term stays, in which case what normally companies, like, for example, short-term stay property managers, what they normally do is they lease out as much as they can, 180 days a year, if possible, under Minpaku, under Airbnb, and then they complement the rest of the year with monthly short-term stays, there's more logistics involved, but it's also a very valid market. People do rent properties out for a month or two or three at a time.
Great. Thank you so much. So we have three questions, which are all about the same general topic, which is basically difference in returns from new buildings versus secondhand buildings, as well as the depreciation of buildings. And if you can resell buildings for the same price, you buy them several years later. Third question is how stable the property price is. So you see all three questions are generally the same. Maybe you can talk about the pricing or depreciation and how that affects returns on new and old buildings.
I'll let Emil start on that, and then I'll drill in deeper into investment aspect.
Sure. So depreciation, it gets a little bit confusing for people because they hear that buildings in Japan are worth nothing after 30 years. They tear them down after 30 years and they're worthless because we're not used to that in sort of other countries. Even an 80-year-old building just gets, renovated, but it still has value. Often we don't even know the age of the building, right? In Australia, my houses that I own there don't know what year they're built even. Approximately a 60s building, a 70s building. In Japan, no, they're very much based on the age. And by accounting laws, if it's a wooden structure, is it 24 years? Is a straight line? Is a depreciation for a wooden?
23 for wooden, 47 for concrete, I think.
Yeah. So again, it's by accounting laws, so 23 years for a wooden structure, you can depreciate it to zero or to 1 yen, and 47 for a concrete structure. And that basically means an apartment building. And that's why the idea the building depreciates over time and is worth nothing. But in practice, the building is not worth nothing unless it's a wooden building that's falling apart, right? I mentioned earlier that there's a property in Shinjuku that we sold for 92.5 million yen, and the bank gave 105, 106% financing in that case. that building, which is, it's a 21-year-old tower mansion. So a tower building, I think it's 35 floors in that building. And the one we bought was on the 19th floor. It has a view of, you know, Tokyo Tower and Tokyo Skytree in the same, out the same sort of living room panoramic window. The purchase price was 92.5. When we were looking at the documents, the original purchase price in 2001 or 2002, when the property was built, was 59 million yen. Okay, so it's gone up from 59 million to 92.5 million in that 20 years. So we can talk about depreciation and accounting depreciation, but basically, since, you know, I think the past almost 20 years, 15 years or so, prior to 15 years, like the Tokyo market was quite flat, but it's just been constantly up year after year after year after year. And now it's, you know, the past 5 years or so, since maybe 2017, was kind of when we've had even stronger growth, even with COVID, even with the uneventful Olympic situation that occurred, they've still been quite strong. So depreciation on paper versus depreciation on, like, in practice is a little bit different. But yeah, if you buy a property, one of the ways to reduce the tax burden is by, by basically doing depreciation on it. Newer buildings have more depreciation available than older ones. So this is also part of the question. A brand new building will have lots of depreciation. So it sort of relates to rental yield. You know, we mentioned in a previous slide, rental yield can be, you know, between 2% to say 8%. If you're looking in Tokyo, a brand new mansion, brand new building in downtown Tokyo will get maybe a 2% rental yield, 2.5% rental yield, because it's very, very new. It's a very attractive building. An investor who looks at that kind of property, often they have a high net income. They're high net worth individuals. Their tax rate is very high. So they want to buy a property which they can depreciate, and their depreciation is going to offset their employment income and their high tax rate of 50%. And after 5 years, when they sell the property, on the capital gain, it's only 20% capital gains tax. So they, by depreciating the property, they've saved 30% of tax every year, even after their long-term capital gains. People who aren't trying to get the tax benefit from depreciation, a slightly older property is, as they get a little bit older, you start to see closer to the 4, 5, 6% rental yields. And that's more cash flow positive. You're not trying to get benefit from depreciation and tax offset, tax write-offs. You're trying to get positive cash flow. So that's how the age of the building, the value of the building, and the investment strategy differs. Some people may say, don't buy old buildings, they're worth nothing, or don't buy new buildings, they depreciate too much. It depends on the investor strategy. And one property that may suit a certain type of investor is different to what will suit a different another investor. So I hope that answers that one. Ziv, do you have something you want to touch on that?
Yeah, I'll add a few small things. So first off, I think it's important to recognize, like Emil was saying, there's a kind of a sweet spot somewhere between 20 to 30 years where you can really maximize the cash flow from a property. So if it's younger than 20 years, like Emil was saying, depreciation will be great, but rental yield will not be so high. As it gets to 30 years, or more importantly, as people can start seeing the 40-year horizon, this is when they start thinking about, okay, well, as the building reaches 40 years of age, maintenance costs start rising more rapidly. It requires more renovations on an annual basis. And then it's expected that it will reduce the yield a lot more rapidly as it reaches the 40-year mark, which is when you'll see also that the price is starting to be affected. So when people are thinking about buying these kinds of properties, they're not only thinking about the current 5 or 6 or 7% that they're getting, they're all also thinking about, well, if I'm going to be paying double building fees per month in a year or two or three, then my yield is going to be severely reduced. So we normally recommend to our clients to purchase properties that are just slightly younger than 30 years or closer to 20 years on purchase, so that it gives them those 5 or 6 or 7 years to make a tidy little profit off it and still sell it without the price dropping off too much. And the other thing, again, location-wise, obviously, again, as Emil was saying, depreciation is a thing and buildings are, maybe the structure loses value, but land still rises in price, definitely in central Tokyo, Osaka, Fukuoka, all of the cities that we've mentioned, but also in other locations that have become popular over time for various reasons. So property prices do go up if the location is attractive. The property always depreciates thing in Japan is more of an accounting thing than an actual market price thing.
Excellent. Thank you very much. We have a question about your services. Other than the company assisting to do the transactions for real estate, do you also help to rent out and manage the buildings?
I think Emil's company definitely does that in Tokyo, right?
Yes. So, yes, yeah, so actually we have, so the realestate.jp is sort of the advertising arm for targeting foreigners, but the actual office that we are at is called Higher Ground. It's largely a Japanese office with about 40 staff. We have 950 apartments under property management. So yeah, if you want to, like if you have a property or, you know, your family home, you want to leave Japan and you want to rent it out, or one of these investment properties that's in Tokyo, so within a 1 hour drive of our office in Ebis, near Shibuya, then yes, we can do the property management. And that basically means you don't do anything. We will list it on the database. If a tenant leaves and it's available, we'll go take photos. We'll list it on the main website, Sumo, and the public websites. We'll list it on the MLS listings database so other agents can also show it. When there's actually an applicant interested, we will do their screening, and they apply also for a guarantee company. And then once that's done, we'll actually send you, do a line chat or a WhatsApp chat. We'll send you the applicant's information and say, you know, hey, Jonathan, this person has applied. Here's their name, their employment, their income, and they've been approved. Do you accept them? Yes or no? And you say, yes, great. Fantastic. We'll do it. And then we'll send you over the deposit that they've paid and the key money and all that sort of stuff. And every month they pay, we'll just transfer. We get into our account at the office and we transfer. We take, I think it's about 4% or 5% of management fee, and we transfer the rest to you. And that's kind of standard. Every agency, like general agencies, will do property management for the most part, but we do it in English. So yeah, we can take care of that. I have some investment properties myself here in Japan that I own, and I have I have our office do it, and I just get treated like a regular client. That's a separate team, and I just, yeah, it's really, really hands off and very passive for that. That's for the Tokyo ones. Ziv, I'll let you explain your service in that regard.
Yeah, so like I mentioned during the intro at the start, anywhere that's, so in Tokyo, we would be using Emil's company, or if it's an area where they don't reach or a property profile that they don't handle, then we will use other companies like theirs. And then we utilize similar companies all over the country. So whichever city we operate in on behalf of a client, we find a local company that does everything that Emil's just explained, and we work with them.
All right. Excellent. Thank you. Next question is about recommended. If you have any specific recommendations on places to invest in Japan, and specifically if you recommend Nagoya.
I think, so what we normally do when we're approached by a new client is we just try to understand. We try to base our location recommendation and the property profile recommendation as well, based on the investor's profile. So everybody comes with different goals from different countries of origin, with different investment portfolios that they've got in various other sectors or countries or what have you. So we first try to get an idea of, for example, if somebody's running a portfolio that's relatively high risk, high reward, speculative, getting high percentage returns, but they're not really sure about capital retainment, then we'd probably direct them into diversifying into something a bit more safe and stable. Maybe they'd be happy with 4 or 5% in Fukuoka or Osaka or Nagoya or what have you, even if it's not super percentage, but it's nice and safe and stable income. Whereas people that have more blue chip stock portfolios that are, you know, just really growing steadily but are not generating high dividends, then maybe they'd want to be more adventurous with their investment portfolio. So it really depends on the investor. Nagoya specifically has not still not gone up in price as much as other locations in Japan. So it started on that track before COVID when they put in the new Shinkansen between Tokyo and Nagoya, and they were clearing up a lot of old properties along the tracks, and it looked like Nagoya was kind of on a stellar path to price growth. But that sort of petered off with COVID. So prices there are still quite attractive. Returns are higher than in other big cities, but the population is also a bit rougher around the edges. So Japan is still Japan. You don't have ghettos and crime labs and squatters and forced evictions. But if and when we do have payment issues or tenants that we, for some reason or another, are chronically late and we have to ask them to leave, then it does tend to happen a little bit more in Nagoya and a few other cities.
And for me, I'm focused more in Tokyo. The numbers are not as attractive in terms of rental yield as other cities. And then even within Tokyo, you know, if you're closer into center, you know, Ibis, Daikanyama, Nakameguro, Shibuya, Shinjuku area, basically the popular ones that you see in the travel books, like real downtown with great access and in the heart of everything. Of course, they tend to be even, you know, more attractive to investors just because it's a nice area. So that kind of pushes up the capital value more than the rent increases. So that's why you get lower returns for newer properties and better locations. And then when you look on a more sort of countrywide scale, that's why Tokyo has lower returns than other regional cities, depending on your particular interest. If you think, I just want to invest in Japan as a financial tool because, you know, I know it's generally safe and the yen is pretty good, like pretty stable, government is stable, then yeah, you can choose some other, you know, other places. A lot of my clients, they'll often have some kind of connection to Japan. Maybe it's a Japanese spouse. Maybe they've lived here for a certain, you know, for several years, so they kind of know what they like already. And often people buy what they know. So that's why, in my case, a lot of the clients are like, no, we've lived in Tokyo and we want to, so we want to maybe in the future be able to come back. So we want to buy in Tokyo. And within Tokyo, yeah, they want a nice kind of property. So they'll only really consider the different returns based on different areas within sort of Tokyo and different ages of buildings, but they still want it to be quite central. And I think one of the questions I saw before is, you know, is there a difference between the different, I think the most recent question, between different wards, if you're in Shibuya-ku or Edogao-ku or Musashino-shi, where Kichijoji is, or Setagaya-ku? Yes, the further away you get, you know, like really central Tokyo, Azabu area, Shibuya ward, Meguro-ku, within sort of that southwest, west and southwest pocket around the Yamanote line, that's quite affluent. So they tend to be a bit more attractive. And then the further out you go within Tokyo, it gets a little bit less affluent, less attractive. And so that means the rental yields are a little bit better. You know, if you want decent ones within Tokyo, then out to Hachioji, for example, you know, far out west, it's still Tokyo, but it really is the far end of sort of you're getting out towards Tokyo.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable. tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens. And they're just a delight to stay in. Fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know. They're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own. But longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home, with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today, see how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now, back to the podcast.
All right, thank you. Jumping back on the depreciation topic in practical terms, if a property where you have an apartment inside is demolished, how does that work?
So how does that work, depreciation wise?
What happens to your property? So you have a property, a mansion, and a small apartment building in a bigger building, and that is set to be demolished. How do you exit the property, or what happens to yours? Is it even possible that they demolish it without your okay? Do you get bought out? Do you get a new property? Or
So
is the end of the life cycle, does something like that exist?
So it's rather the question sort of, I think the right phrasing for that question would be more along the lines of, how do they go about agreeing to tear down a building to begin with, and what happens, what is the process? So I believe it's about 80% of the owners need to agree.
Yeah, exactly 80%. Yeah, they're working to change that to a lower percentage, but at the moment it's still 80%.
Yeah, so 80% need to agree to tear it down. So that means that a lot of people like just are fed up with the building. It's old, it's run down, it's falling apart. So 80% is a lot of people that don't like the building that they're living in and are willing to tear it down. Okay. And then they have to pay to rebuild it. So it doesn't actually happen too commonly. And even once they agree, it's almost a 7 to 10 year long process from when they agree to when it actually happens. But again, it's complex. It's like, so where are the people going to move? How are they going to fund it? Where is the money even coming from? Rather, what would happen if it's an old building? Realistically, if when you're going to buy a property, it's probably not going to be close to that state. If we as an investment or for your own home, it's not going to be at that kind of level that it needs to be sort of torn down in the next 1 to 2 decades. But if you do happen to sort of be in that situation, well, then it's like, well, how are they going to fund it? If you're not able to fund it, chances are that over 20% of the residents are not going to agree to it. If they are, it could be because a developer has come in and said, look, your particular building allows like the zoning in this, we can actually build 2 or 3 times the size of it. So what we'll do is, look, we'll let us get it and we'll give you a new property within this new build complex that we build. You get a brand new one and we'll give you a hotel or a property to live in for the 12 to 24 months it takes to build this next building. And you can get a new place, and we as a developer will make our money through selling all the other properties. But realistically, I think you won't be in a situation that the property you buy is going to get to that stage. Rather, what happens is the building just continually gets maintained, right? Even now, the 60-year-old buildings, rather the opposite. If they tear them down, the new property they can build may not be as big or will be equal in size to what is already there. So it's not really worth paying all that just to redo it, you know, redo the same building, and you have to move out for 2 years. What they'll rather do is just continuously maintain and take care of the existing building.
What does often happen with these buildings that Emil was just describing is, so again, if you think about zoning regulations, they tend to get stricter over time. So in the past, there wasn't really much zoning regulations to speak of. And then they started saying, okay, well, the roads have to be this wide. This is a residential neighborhood. We need the spaces to be this much apart and so forth. So normally these days, zoning regulations for buildings that have been built decades ago are more strict. So it's not worth it for a developer to compensate, say, 100 unit owners if they're only going to be able to build a 20 or 30 unit block in that location. They're not going to give a unit or the equal compensation amount of a unit to each and every owner. So what they tend to do in these cases is, and that's another reason that we, for example, recommend not to go for buildings that are too old, is as the building reaches that 40-year mark again, the developers start sniffing around. They want to buy the plot, but they don't want to compensate that much. So they'll make, they'll buy a few units in the building at normal market prices from some owners, and then that gives them voting rights on the owner union. And then they'll start pushing from within to convince owners to sell the building until they get to that 80%. And they take their time doing it too. If it's a good land plot, they'll take, in our case, what they've done it to us, it's taken them 6 years, I think, that they were working on the owner union until they managed to get that 80%. And then they'll buy it off people's hands at market price or slightly higher or slightly lower, but definitely not a super attractive deal.
Thank you, guys. So I'm conscious of the time. We are now about 1 hour. I think we've covered a lot of topics. I know you guys have agreed to stay on a little bit longer. So maybe if people want to just ask questions directly from now, I think we can try that out as well. You guys are good with time, right? So yeah, I would say let's just open the floor up to people to ask questions. One thing I wanted to share, though, my experience was when I started looking at investment properties here, I was really surprised at how low of a price some of these apartments start. I mean, $20,000-$30,000, you can already get an old apartment in the outskirts of Tokyo. I was really surprised with that. So I just wanted to share that. But yeah, if somebody wants to just go ahead and unmute themselves and ask directly and make it a little bit more of an open discussion for however long people want to stay, go ahead.
Why don't we just actually, because there are quite a few people, maybe just raise your hands for anyone who wants a question.
All right, good.
We also still have a bunch of questions that we haven't touched on in the chat, I think.
Yeah. Okay, so raise your hands. And also, I just put on my screen, sort of, if you want to connect with us, so actually I'll put Ziv's one up here first. So you can drop us an email. So I'm sales@realestate.jp. So, and also look, sometimes with these kind of questions, you know, it may be a bit personal. If you want to buy your own house, how much funding can I get? This is my income. This is my situation. I live here. I'm on this visa, etc. You don't want to just ask it, you know, in this public forum or semi-public forum. Feel free to send me an email, sales@realestate.jp. Or if you're looking at investment property sort of elsewhere, you know, Ziv's email is there, you know, zivmagan@nippontradings.com and his website. Yeah, so please feel free to do that. Or if you want to connect with us, okay, I'll leave the socials up. So on Facebook, we changed from, you know, it was Tokyo Realty and we had some other branding before. The realestate.jp is very, very new. So I think the website right now still only shows the seminar, the conference we had last month. I haven't had a chance to even update that. But yeah, on Facebook, www.realestate.jp is the Facebook name. We're on starting up on Instagram. Send me an email, it's probably the easiest. And on YouTube, Japan_real_estates is the YouTube channel, which Ziv manages. He has lots of his deal analysis, lots of his clients on there. And we, Ziv and I and three others also do a weekly podcast and vlog that's available on the Japan Real Estate Pod. If you just on any podcast platform, if you search Japan Real Estate Podcast or on YouTube, the Japan Real Estate, you will find our group doing the Japan Real Estate Experts panel, just talking real estate. So reach out to myself or to Ziv, and we'll be happy to connect. Usually, if you want to reach out to me, the first thing I'll say is, okay, let's organize a Zoom call and spend 45 minutes or 1 hour talking about your situation and how I can help. But primarily, if you're looking at properties in Tokyo, or if you're, you know, a local resident in Japan and you want to buy your family home in Tokyo, that's what I do. Other kind of stuff, Ziv is your man. But let's jump over to questions. I see one hand raised. So, okay, so Simon, you can please unmute and ask your question.
All right. Emil, Ziv, Benjamin, thanks so much for sharing. So my question for you is, you assist in making transactions and purchases, right? You say that we don't need to leave our countries. You help us to do all of that admin. We just need to send the cash over. So does your company also manage those properties for a fee? And that means looking for tenants, onboarding, offboarding, paying of taxes, funds, and whatever kind of mail that come from the authorities will be sent to your representative in your company. Like, do you guys provide that kind of service for a fee? And what would that fee look like?
For our office, in terms of mail management, most of the clients we have will have their own sort of mailing address, maybe a relative because they lived here before. So all the property management, they tend to be sort of local. I don't know if mail comes to our office. I'm not sure about that, to be honest, because that's a separate team. But in terms of the fees, generally with property management, it's the same sort of any, you know, the standard market is when a new tenant signs the lease, okay, we found a new tenant, it's 1 month leasing fee. Okay, so if you just say it's a 100,000 yen a month property, when they join, you as the owner need to pay us, the agent, as a 1 month of the leasing fee. And then ongoing, it'll be about 4 to 5%, depends on the value of the rent, of the rent as ongoing management. So if it's 100,000 yen a month, we'll take about 4 or 5,000 yen per month. And that's kind of it. A standard Japanese lease is renewed every 2 years. And at renewal, the tenant needs to pay 1 month of rent as a contract renewal fee. And I believe that time, the agency, us, we take 50% and you take 50%. And that's it. And that's kind of, look, not just our office, that's kind of standard with most Japanese agents, but we also do it in English. That's our process. Again, for properties in Tokyo that we can physically get to within an hour or so. But I'll hand over to Ziv because their model is slightly different to ours.
Yeah. So again, we come in as an added layer. So all of those things that you've mentioned, Simon, we can also be the contact person for utility companies. We can be the contact person for your annual property tax payment. And we manage the property managers, whether it's Emil's company, if it's in Tokyo, or other companies anywhere else. And then whatever function they don't fulfill, or if for any reason, if they're strictly Japanese and they can't deal with the foreigner, we fulfill that function and we charge an additional 3,000 yen per property on top of the 4 or 5% that they charge.
And the rents that we collect, how would that be remitted to our overseas account, assuming that we can't open an account in Japan?
So if it's done through us, we will be collecting your rent, paying your expenses. We provide an annual income and expenses statement. But if at any point the rates, for example, swing one way or the other, you want to transfer more money over, we can also give you an approximate approximation of how much you've got held throughout the year and just remit based on that. If we overshoot, we can recoup that from your rental income. So that's not an issue for us. In any case, you don't want to be withdrawing monthly because international remittance fees will eat significantly into your rental income. And you also don't want to remit because you need money in a hurry. The best idea is usually to watch the exchange rates. And then once they peak in your favor, instruct us to just remit whatever you've got held over to you.
Okay, got it. Thanks. That was helpful.
No worries.
And with our case, our office is sort of similar. We will remit every month, actually. We don't really hold it in our account. Generally, our clients, because they've either have lived here before, and so they have an account, or they have a Japanese spouse or some kind of connection, so they'll still have a local account which we can remit to. Otherwise, if it's an overseas account, we can remit to that, but there is the added sort of cost of international transfers that need to be borne by the owner, not by us, because it gets to be a little bit costly. And are there any other hands raised, or if anyone has a question, they can raise their hands. But I think there are people in the chat.
I think they're just writing it in the chat.
Yeah, they're just writing it in the chat, so that's fine. Is anyone else with their camera on? Let's see. Yeah. No camera people.
There was one question about earthquakes.
Sure. First, I see Nancy's got her hand up, so let's let Nancy. Nancy can unmute and ask a question, and then we'll jump on the earthquake one.
Yeah, and if people who wrote their questions in the chat, if you want to maybe instead just raise your hand and ask them live if you can. If not, we'll go over to the chat once we're done with the live hand.
Thank you, Shem, so much. That is a very nice idea, because I was trying to type, but it takes a shorter time to raise and talk right now. Thank you so much. So I'm working for a Japanese corporate that actually has the expat outside Japan that always come back to Japan for work. So we had a rent at the monthly apartment from time to time. So I was wondering if, because you were talking about Airbnb and you were talking about the long-term property, the house investment, what about the property that is for short-term rent? I mean, does the Minpaku law force this type of property investment too? Like the property that is offered the rent in the short term. Yes, cool. That is only one of my questions right now.
So I just want to rephrase your question. It's is Minpaku, like, does Minpaku allow to do these monthly kind of mansions for company people coming to work here for 2 or 3 month periods? Is that kind of?
Okay, my question is, for example, if I would like to invest in the property and lease and give the rent as a short term, like a monthly mansion, not a long term, but for years, because it has a better and better we can get better higher rent. I'm not sure, but that's what I see. So that's which law is related to this kind of investment? Is it the Minpaku law, or is there any other type of law that control this kind of investment?
So monthly mansions are not covered by Minpaku. Like if the person comes, let's say it's a company transfer that they're here for a project for 3 months. Okay, so it's considered, like, they call it monthly mansions, and often it's a furnished place. Oakwood Residence is a very popular one that does that. They have lots of branches everywhere. And so some of the expats that come for 1, 2, 3, 4 month sort of stays will stay at one of those places. And now people have started doing their own apartments, what was used to be for Airbnb, these monthly mansion stays where they need to sign a lease agreement and be at least 28 days or more. Okay. So they are not covered by Minpaku. It's a standard lease, short-term lease agreement. However, now some mansions are actually saying, not only is it no Minpaku, they don't permit Minpaku, they knew that some of people are doing these workarounds where they'll say, like, they'd use monthly mansions, and they say, oh, actually, that's not a minpaku business, so it doesn't count. Now some more attractive mansions are putting restrictions in place in their policy, that in the building laws, that say no monthly mansion or furnished mansion or serviced apartments. You're not permitted to do that as well. They don't like
you the idea. You can often still work around that, though, if the property management company is accustomed to dealing with owner unions that don't like that. They'll have their ways around it.
But as buying a property where you have to deal with that, is, let's say, it's easier just to buy a property where you don't need to deal with that. And also it's challenging because there are now, I was talking on our podcast, there's this lady, Tracy Northcote, and she's a short-term stay manager, and that's her business, right? She has Minpaku properties, and she's a Minpaku registered management company, and that's what she does. And for these short-term stays, right now it's actually, the competition is quite high. You have these large corporations that, and large, like basically almost like full building, service department buildings, that's exactly what they do. And they have direct agreements with the relocation companies and with corporations. So this monthly mansions for big company transfers are becoming quite B2B, not B2C. So I think it's going to be challenging. The Airbnb route is the one where you get higher return. And because of the 180-day regulation, that's why people put the monthly mansions on top. But the monthly mansions are very hard to fill because they're not as flexible as Airbnb. But Airbnb's got 180 days. So if you're coming in now as a new investor, get a hotel license. Don't get a place that you can only do 180 days Airbnb and you want to do maybe some short-term stay to fill the gap. No. Get something that can get registered as a hotel. Buy the right property at the right time. The days of pre-regulation where you could do anything with Airbnb is no longer around. So get the right property at the beginning.
In our experience as well, the monthly route is good if, again, you have a property that you want to use a few months a year and then you want to do whatever you can do with it. And especially if it's a condo unit where you cannot do Minpaku at all, then, you know, the monthly might be a kind of a way to cover your annual expenses. But looking for an actual investment property, either, I mean, you'll be aiming for different criteria during the purchase research phase already. It's going to be, if you really want to go for a short-term rental business, as Emil was saying, set up a company in Japan. It comes with the $2,000-$4,000 a year company upkeep costs and just work on an actual short-term stay business with a hotel license. Otherwise, you're kind of patchworking, hybriding it, and it's not going to make the best returns, and it's not going to be a comfortable property for you to stay in.
Thank you so much. That is really nice to know. Yeah, it's really insightful. Yes, thank you so much.
Awesome.
Okay, any other questions or we'll jump to the chats? Okay, Chris has raised his hand.
I'll just hijack the conversation. A quick one from me. So I'm speaking on behalf of some of the residents here who are not permanent residents yet. So many may know, PR is not so easy to get sometimes. And the loans, I believe quite a few banks, they have mentioned that they typically don't loan, they don't give loans to foreigners who are not permanent residents. So is there any way that we can get around that?
It's not get around it. It's what the... different banks have different criteria. There's the standard one. If you want to get, so for the Japanese home loan, right? Ideal situation is you get 105% financing at the 0.5, 0.7% low Japanese interest rate. Ideal situation. In order to get that, you need to be a Japanese citizen. In your case, you're not. The next one is you may be permanent residents. which in this case, you said, well, what if you're not permanent resident? The next one is, do you have a Japanese spouse, or is your wife spouse Japanese or a permanent resident themselves? No. Okay. Next one is, well, are you married?
No, I just have a company in Japan.
Okay, you have come. Okay, so the next one is, if you're married, like, to still try to get the 100% financing, if you're married and have been at the same company for over 5 years on a 5-year visa, we had one couple, like, you can still get 100% financing. We had one couple just in December. It bought a 95, I think about 90 to 95 million yen brand new house in Shinagawa Ward, Nakanobu area, that they were both like a French and Swedish couple. They just had a baby. The wife was on maternity leave. But they've been in Japan for, I think, right on 5 years, employed at the same company for 5 and 7 years. And they got 100% financing at the interest rate was 1.45%. Okay. Which is a little bit high for Japanese standards. But they know once they get to the 10-year mark and they get their permanent residency, they can refinance. Okay, so they thought, look, we just had a baby. We are okay with, like, you're talking from 0.7, it goes up to 1.45 for 5 years, but that's not crazy. If they were, so for some people don't know, often if to get permanent residency, you need to live here for 10 years, right? So if you're on your 9th year and you're just 1 year away from PR, I'll tell people, look, just wait for PR and then you can get the good interest rates. But they were 5 years away. So it's like, it's fine. 1.4 is still not terrible. The moment you get PR, you want to refinance to like a 0.7 or 0.5% rate. That's fine. You can do that. So that's what they did. Now, the next one down is, I think where you're at is, if you do not have permanent residency, you don't meet those requirements, then the next thing is you can get 80% financing. You need to put 20% deposit. And there are lots of banks that I can introduce you to that we can do that for you. However, you said you own a business. So it becomes a lot more challenging, even for Japanese citizens who are business owners. They're the representative director and not an employee. You can only get 80% financing. They won't give you 100% financing. And then if you have, if it's a small business where it's just one company and the employees are you and your spouse, or just you and one other person, or could just be you, right? Often you'll show your income as being very low, just, you know, for tax management, of course. So the bank will say, hold on a second, you're getting paid 2 million yen per year. That's not enough. They're like, no, but my company, like, I do this for tax. Yeah, it doesn't matter. They're seeing 2 million yen a year. That's the income that you're paying yourself. And they take that seriously. Then they'll give you based on that amount, right? So often I tell people, if you're a business owner, even if you have permanent residency, you need to kind of forecast, well, I want to buy a house. So in 2 years' time, I need to be earning 8, 9, 10 million yen a year. So your business needs to be doing so much, such business that your income that your company's paying you, and you unfortunately have to pay tax on, those kind of numbers. So I hope that answers your questions, Chris.
Thank you very much. I mean, maybe I'll connect with you on LinkedIn and I'll ask you about the banks that you have on hand.
Sure.
Thank you very much.
I just realized before this, maybe like 2 hours ago, before this started, I haven't used LinkedIn for almost a decade. I still had my old employer, so I've just quickly updated it. I think it's been nothing for like 10 years or so. So please ignore the issues. You're actually a lot better off just sending me an email, to be honest. I don't
get
linked.
I'll do that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No worries. Okay.
All right. Any more raised hands, or are we going to the chat? All right, chat. It is.
I think some questions from Chris. He mentioned that. So I think, but he just asked. Okay, so Kia asked. Okay, so I'm just scrolling from the top down. If we intend to buy a property in Tokyo from our own stay during our vacation there, what is the best way to optimize rent earning opportunities for the period when we are not there, either short leases or Airbnb? Okay, I think we've discussed that. And that's kind of the situation where I think it's okay to try to do short-term rentals or Airbnb if it's a full house. Is if it's your actual own residence, it's a place that you bought, you live, you want to live there. The goal is not to maximize rental return. The goal is more just you have your own property, but when you're not there, you don't want it to be dead space or it just lost money. So that's where, yeah, you could find some monthly mansions, or if you can register for Airbnb, then Airbnb as well. But if you're buying for where you want to live and your benefit is a nice holiday house or a nice base in Japan, expect that you're paying to get a nice property that's personal, not maximize the ROI. So you just want to kind of fill it with some short-term stays or some Airbnb, but you're not going to be maximizing that. If you want to maximize it as an investment, when you buy the property, your focus should be, can this thing get a hotel license? So that was Kiat's question at 9:30.
I think I'll quickly address one under that from Freya. I think she's no longer here, but hopefully she'll be able to watch the recording. So she mentions that we talked about in one of the older podcast episodes, we talked about holding on to real estate investment properties for a couple of years and then selling them. Is it possible to sell them for more or less the same amount you bought it? So first off, I wouldn't say a couple of years, because capital tax is doubled if you're selling within 5 years from purchase. So just in case you did happen to gain on the property value, paying a lot of tax on that. So usually we recommend to start looking at that after about 5 or 6 years. And then investment properties are normally purchased by investors. They're going to be, the cash cows are usually studio or one bedroom apartments that anyone who can afford to buy them wouldn't want to live in them. They're smaller, older buildings, and anyone who lives there as a tenant is probably not going to be able to afford to buy them. So they're strictly investment properties, and then they're priced based on the rental yield that they generate. So if the area is more or less the same, the rental yield is more or less the same, nothing drastic has changed yield-wise or location-wise, it's going to sell for about the same price. If it's in a location that became more popular since you've purchased and people are accustomed to lower yields there, then you'll be able to sell at a profit. And if for any reason rental yield has gone down, either because building fees have gone up significantly or because rental amounts have dropped, then you're going to sell at a slight loss. We haven't had customers exit at any major losses. Some of them have gained slightly. Some of them have gained a lot if the area became super popular. Some of them remain stable or dropped by 5 or 10% at most. So if you're generating from your investment, let's say conservatively 5% a year, you've got 5 years times 5%, you've made your 25% return. Then even if you sell at 5 or 10% loss, you've still well in the green. That's been our experience.
So let's see. Some of the other questions I'm scrolling through, I think, like Nancy,
we answered a lot of them, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we've answered some, like in just sort of how we're talking. That was probably by change over time, life cycle, but I think we sort of discussed that. So Freya's one, Simon, foreigners don't reside in Japan, other new countries. Give me a minute, scanning through.
Implications of earthquake, while you're scrolling in me, I'll just answer that. Earthquake risks. In Japan, you're insured against earthquakes. So you're going to be purchasing policies that cover you for 5 years at a time and then renewing them. In the case of a total loss, you're going to get about 50% of the official evaluation of the property, which can be slightly different to market price. Other disasters like fire or floods or whatnot can be covered up to 100% of the official evaluation of the property. It varies depending on the type and extent of the damage, but anyway, you're insured against earthquakes. U.S. tax question there. I'm not a U.S. citizen myself, so can't speak from experience, but yes, as far as I'm aware, the U.S. will tax you regardless where in the world you're living. So you do need to officially let them know about your earnings out of the States. But there is a tax treaty between the US and Japan. So you're not going to be taxed twice. You're just going to be taxed for the difference. So if you're paying
let's say 40% in the US and 20% in Japan, because your income is different and taxation is different here, then you'll be paying the initial 20% in Japan, and then the US might tax you for the extra 20% on the remaining amount.
The very last question, the most recent one from Anthony Reed, reads, have you ever experienced a situation where you are looking to buy out residents in a mansion and they are asking for a lease buyout? So when you talk about lease buyout, you mean there's someone that is renting the mansion?
Are you still with us, Anthony? Do you want to maybe hop on stage and ask that? I think he's still here in the audience.
Yeah, so if Anthony wants to unmute and ask, because I'm a bit unsure about that. He's trying.
Yep.
Hey, Anthony, sure. So go ahead, please just like rephrase your question so I can understand.
Sure. I was just thinking sort of in the situation of a combined office residential space, and you have like a mix of tenants, land, building owners, et cetera. And in order to get like that 80% that you're looking for, some of them have asked, would you be willing to take over the remainder of their lease in that building? If they have like a 35-year lease in the building or so, and they have like 5-7 years left in the lease, in order to get that 80% like majority to, in order to like to tear down the building, have you ever come across a situation where you buy out the remaining time on those leases in order to get them out?
I think the assumption on the lease, lease terms in Japan are 2 years, and the lease terms are for renters, not owners.
So commercial leases could be up to 5 years, I think. I haven't seen anything much longer than that.
Okay.
But so if, and lease agreements, depending on it, if it's a typical traditional Japanese lease, then it's very hard to evict the tenant. You need to pay them a lot to have them leave. But it's just not such a common thing to happen. Like the people, like developers wanting to come in and tear down a building and buy everyone out is not very common. And then if they do want to, then yes, there's also going to say, well, if there's maybe the owner wants to sell, but even if the owner sells a property, the tenancy agreement cannot be broken. It is sold with a tenancy agreement. And if that tenant doesn't want to leave, you need to start offering them lots of cash so that they leave. And if they decide that they just don't want to leave, then you really can't do anything about it. You can't evict them. So it's...
Just add that if you're selling to a developer, I wouldn't be concerned about that, because they either factor that cost of running out the lease into their costing, or they have ways that we don't even want to know about to get tenants out. So if you're selling the entire building to a developer, they're going to have an issue with that.
Okay, cool. Thanks. Appreciate that.
But you as an individual are unlikely to be in a position where you're buying a property that you are going to want to remove people from it so you can tear it down and rebuild. If you're going to come in there as an investor, then you're probably going to look for a vacant block of land to build what you want, not find a block of land that you want to evict everyone from. The big boys do that, like with, you know, very, very expensive sort of old buildings in central downtown that are worth doing. Individuals won't be doing this. So I hope that answers your question.
There's a last question there, I think, that's yours, Emil, about mortgage for PRs versus Japanese spouse and so forth.
Okay, so
maybe I could explain that. That was my question. I was just really interested in what you said about the for a business owner, for a business owner, you generally want to, like, on paper, reduce your income, and then that, from a bank's perspective, they don't like that because they're just looking at how much income somebody has. In my case, I am a business owner. I do have PR and a Japanese spouse. So for someone who's a business owner with a Japanese spouse, and I'm sorry if this is maybe like too specific, is it still generally better to go through the Japanese citizen for a bank loan, whether it's either for a personal home or for an investment property?
No, not at all. And actually, it's better being very specific because I can answer it very specifically. So part of my job is like, licensed agents, there's no general mortgage brokers in Japan. The agent, because the banks don't make a lot of money and the banks don't give a kickback or a commission or a trail to the mortgage broker. Rather, their loan office, the mortgage centers for the mega banks will have a loan officer assigned to our agency who will allow us to submit loan applications on our client's behalf, because we want to successfully get the loan so that we can make the deal and get our 3% commission on the sale of the property. So I deal with loans, you know, several times a week, and that's all we're doing. So your specific situation I can actually speak to very, very specifically, and I like these specifics. Having the permanent residency means the Japanese spouse, like you can get divorced and it makes no difference. You have PR, that's the main thing. It doesn't matter. There's no benefit.
I never said anything about that.
Oh, yeah, no. I'm just just talking pipe dream. So you can, the permanent residency or Japanese citizenship requirement is just one of the checkboxes in the mortgage application. It's so for in terms of residency, are you a Japanese citizen or a permanent resident? If it's yes, great, you clear that hurdle. Now we go to the next one. So there's no benefit of, once you meet that, they're equivalent in terms of the bank's assessment. There's no benefit of saying, let's do it through my wife or through me because my wife is the Japanese. No. And in fact, it's not about doing it through the Japanese citizen or the permanent residency holder. It's who's the primary earner, who earns more money. Right, where's the income coming from? If your wife is not employed, then she can't get a loan anyway. But what the banks will say is, okay, ideally, are you a Japanese citizen or permanent resident? They want to just understand that this is your home. The chance of you just leaving to another country is minimal. And then once you've checked that, great. If you're not permanent resident, then they say, well, okay, what else can you show us that you actually make this your home? Say, oh, well, my spouse is Japanese, okay, or she's a permanent resident holder. Then, okay, some banks will say, okay, that's the residency requirement checkbox. Great. So it's not about the Japanese citizen being the primary, like in her name. That's not it. It's rather, do you meet the bank's checkbox requirement? So in this case, your permanent residency, fantastic. We can go to the next process. It's your spouse being Japanese is irrelevant. Right, because you've already met that requirement. Now we talk about your employment situation. You say do you have your business or your kojin jigyo, like a sole proprietor? So do you have actually a KK established?
I have been a sole proprietor, but I'm considering turning that into a business entity.
Okay.
I mean, sure. I don't know if this is too specific. I wanted to try to phrase the question in a way that was more relevant to the audience.
Oh, no, because that's fine. I can speak to it in both ways. And it's fine. This is the time for you to ask your specific question, and I'll answer it specific to you, but also give, you know, like I mentioned, some broader scope of how it's considered by the banks. So if you're not a typical salaried employee, then... So if you're a salaried employee, the banks will like just say you work for Sony or Dentsu or something like that. The bank will just say, okay, what's your gross annual income? You're on 8 million yen a year. We'll give you about 7 to 8 times your gross annual income. That's how they calculate it. Up to 105% financing. No problem. Now you've gone, okay, you're either a business owner or sole proprietor, which for the bank is kind of the same bucket. Okay. Because you control your numbers. Right. Even if you own a company, you can kind of make up whatever numbers you want. You'll have to pay tax on them as fictitious they may be. But that's why once you're in that category, they'll only give you 20% financing. 80% financing, and you'll need 20% deposit plus about 5 to 7% closing costs. There is a situation though where in the situation where you're a sole proprietor, all of your revenue just say you make 100,000, like 10 million yen of revenue, you say, you know, 3 million of expenses, your net profit, net, you know, income is going to be 7 million yen. And then there'll be some deductions about, you know, spouse deduction, child deduction, other sort of stuff. But in terms of your business calculation, they say, what's your gross income minus your business expenses? That's your gross, that's your net business income. That's what they calculate your borrowing capacity. And they'll give you 7 to 8 times that, but only up to 80% financing. If you establish a company, it's similar. Okay, you have a company, the company makes 10 million yen of revenue. You're going to be, and they'll have expenses, and you're going to just be getting a straight up fixed salary from that as a director. And if that salary is 5%, is 5 million yen, 6 million yen, 7 million yen, whatever it is, they're going to assess it on that. But sometimes when people establish a company like that, one of the ways for tax mitigation is if your spouse is not working, they'll say, okay, give 4 million yen to me, 3 million yen to my wife. And then the kind of the way it's calculated is you overall, you're on a lower tax bracket because you disperse it amongst two people. And so that's more beneficial in terms of tax management. But hey, when Alex wants to buy a house, what's your income? 4 million yen. Ooh, okay, that's not as good as 7 million is what it was. And you're also going to want to see, show us the business P&L, because you're the director, show us the Kestansho, the P&L. Is the company in the red or in the black? They'll also do that assessment. There is one Japanese government scheme called Flat 35 that for business owners or sole proprietors, they will give you up to 100% financing or even 105% financing if you meet certain requirements. And that's almost 8 to 9, like almost 8 times or 9 times your annual income or salary. So again, if you're making that 7 million yen as a sole proprietor after expenses, that's what you're declaring as taxable income. They'll give you maybe 80 million yen or 70 million, no, sorry, like 60 million yen, maybe even closer to 70 million yen in financing for that. But they're a bit stricter on the property.
I think bottom line is, Alex, it really depends on whether your wife is earning or not. And that will dictate whether she's employed or not, earning or not, and how much she's earning in comparison with you, I think will dictate. So maybe it's a conversation that you want to have with an accountant before deciding whether you're going to switch into a Godogaisha, whatever the case may be.
Okay, got it. Thank you very much. Very helpful.
But if, Alex, feel free to reach out to me. Where are you located? Which prefecture?
Well, so I'm actually in Singapore at the moment, but it's a long story.
Okay, sure. Well, look, feel free, like if you really have like a more, you know, because again, there's lots of nuances for your situation. And even timing. Okay, you haven't been here. When you do come back, how it works, how the banks, do they want you to be here for 1 year, 2 year, 3 years, all that sort of discussion. Send me an email and I'm happy to, when you're ready, jump on a Zoom with you and your wife and really discuss the ins and outs specific for your situation.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the question is basically just planning for the future.
Oh yeah. Most of my calls are like that. And then in a year or two time, I get the response, like, you know, the follow-up email, hey, Emil, we made it. We're back and we're settled here. Great. Let's get the ball rolling. So yeah,
that's, something like that.
It's a long pipeline. Yeah. So happy to have that discussion. So it's important because we need to have the discussion now. So at least you can strategize and do it right. So in 2 years' time, when you get here or when it's done, you don't have, like, you're already set up. Whereas if you wait till you get here in 2 years' time, then have the discussion, you're like, oh, crap, I got to wait another 2 years because I didn't set it right. Let's have that 45-minute, one-hour discussion early. So you're always, you know, at least as best prepared. You know, you don't lose 1 or 2 years because of you missed on a 45-minute phone call.
I appreciate it.
We've also got a live, I think the slide maybe didn't mention that. If you're on Facebook, just search for a Japan Real Estate Group. We also run that one, and it's very informative. There are a lot of people, obviously us, but also a lot of other knowledgeable people who participate there.
Can I ask one just small follow-up thing? The meeting that you did last month, the seminar. I heard that would be recorded. I didn't get a chance to attend live, but I'd love to watch the recording if it's available somewhere.
Yeah, they're all on the YouTube channel now. If you go to youtube.com/Japan_real_estate, they've all been uploaded there. Oh, except, the videos are all there. The presentations are also available for download from our website or directly from Emil.
And excuse the audio.
We'll improve that next time.
You can still hear it, but it's not as clear as we weren't mic'd up properly. So apologies for that.
That's all right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
It was a great seminar. Wow. We had so many people in there for the whole time. 65 people or so in the venue, 20 people on Zoom. It was great.
Yeah. All right. I think we've answered all of the questions. Are we good, Benjamin?
I think it's good. I think it was fantastic. Thank you so much. I know I had a lot of takeaway. I think everybody else did as well. So thanks again. Thanks for your time.
Cool.
Fantastic. Well, pleasure speaking with you.
Cool. Thanks, everyone. Thank you for
thanks, guys.
Now 45.
Cheers.
Enjoy that bottle of whiskey, Emu.
I got it right here.
Get into some of that myself, actually. All right. Have a good night, folks.
Have a good night.
Thank you so much. Good night. Bye.
Pleasure. Bye-bye.
All right, that was a pretty good session, wasn't it? I love it when they go on and on and on like this. Q&A is always where the magic happens and the best information comes up, and this time was no different. Hope you found some value in it. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa, and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company and you've got any sort of business or visa related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com. And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks, and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time, and until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku!